Support for this KQED podcast comes from Stanford Blood Center. Stanford Blood Center is a proud supporter of KQED and encourages you to support local patients by donating blood. Learn more at bloodcenter.stanford.edu.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the 50th birthday of Medicare, the health insurance program for seniors and people with disabilities that Ronald Reagan warned would end freedom in America, remains very popular with voters. But with its high costs, will it last? We talk with a panel of experts on the roles Medicare and its sister program Medicaid have played in healthcare delivery, both nationwide and in California, and how the program might change as baby boomers reach retirement age and Americans live longer. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. President Lyndon Johnson established Medicare 5 decades ago for people with disabilities and the elderly. In 1965, nearly half of all seniors nationwide were uninsured. Today, the federal health coverage program covers some 55 million people, nearly 6 million in California alone, and it's been credited with extending lives. No surprise that the program remains popular. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll finds Democrats, Republicans, and independents ages 65 and older value Medicare by vast majorities and want to keep it intact. But with its high costs, how long will it be around? Joining me to look at the past and future of Medicare and its sister program, Medicaid, known as Medi-Cal here, are Lawrence Baker. He's professor of health research and policy at Stanford University. Welcome, Lawrence Baker.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
We're also joined by Dr. Andrew Beinman, professor of medicine, health policy, epidemiology, and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. He's also director of the University of California Medicaid Research Institute and director of UCSF's Primary Care Research Fellowship. He helped draft the Affordable Care Act. Welcome, Dr. Andrew Beinman.
Oh, thanks. It's very, very fun to be here. Thank you.
We're also joined by Diane Rowland. She's Executive Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation. She's directed the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured since 1991 and overseen the foundation's health policy work on Medicaid and Medicare, among other issues. Welcome to the program, Diane Rowland.
Delighted to be with you.
Diane Rowland, I'd like to start with you since I noted the Kaiser Family Foundation's 50th anniversary poll earlier. It's clear people like their Medicare.
It's very clear that people like their Medicare and have from its very enactment. It filled a very important gap in the ability of elderly people to get access to care. And then later, when it added people with permanent and total disabilities, really became the fundamental safety net for that population as well. But the other surprise is that Medicaid itself is also a popular program. Many think that it's only Medicare, but when we did the poll, we noted that 66% of the population said that they rated the Medicaid program as very important, just slightly below that of Medicare. And many talked about the fact that they now have a connection to the program, either through a family member who's received care or through their own use of the program at various times.
Which is so interesting because it was very controversial back in 1965. I mean, there were terms like this was socialized medicine, even Soviet-style programs. So can you talk about how the program came to be for a moment? I'd love to just touch on the history.
Well, certainly way back to Harry Truman, there was an attempt to try and get national health insurance for the population. It was a priority of President Kennedy during his time. But with his death, Lyndon Johnson made Medicare his prime priority for going into his first full year in office and really did push to make sure that it was part of what he called his war on poverty that also included trying to help the poorest in the nation as well. So that's why you ended up seeing the combination program, Medicare for the elderly, built on the Social Security system as the next step in Social Security for the nation's elderly population, and then adding in a way to help the poorest of the poor through the Medicaid program.
Andrew Bynum, the programs also helped end discrimination. I mean, it barred federal funding for institutions that discriminated on the basis of race. Can you talk a little bit about how it did that, how it was a motivator for ending forms of discrimination at that time?
Well, what you bring up is a really important part of the role that these programs have played to address disparities in the United States. At the time that these programs were implemented, we had hospitals that would segregate black and white patients. We had African-Americans who attempted to get privileges to work in certain hospitals who were barred from those kinds of opportunities. It was really part of what was known as the Jim Crow days in the United States of really separate separating people by race and giving them very different treatments. So the availability of these health insurance programs really said, if you want to be able to get the payments that are available from these programs, you need to change your practices in hospitals. And overnight, essentially, the availability of the funds through these programs started to change very dramatically these programs. And so things that seem unimaginable today in terms of how we treated people in hospitals in separate ways were addressed and overcome. And this was really a very dramatic change in how healthcare was delivered and something very positive, again, in addressing disparities in healthcare.
And Lawrence Baker, you've really looked at how Medicare and Medicaid, but let's focus on Medicare for a second, have really changed and influenced our healthcare delivery system nationwide. Do you want to touch on a couple other examples before we delve into its future?
Oh, sure. Well, so Medicare over time has really been a driving force for changes in payment in the U.S. healthcare system. Medicare was one of the places where we developed some of the common payment hospital payment systems we use today and has been really important in trying to drive other reforms in the healthcare system. Right now, under the Affordable Care Act, Medicare is trying to catalyze the formation of larger and more integrated healthcare delivery systems that some people think might be able to improve care. So Medicare is really partly because of its size and because of the influence that it has throughout the country, been a place where new things can be tried. And, you know, it's a large bureaucracy at some level, too. But in some ways, then, surprisingly, it's been able to innovate and really lead. Lots of private health insurance companies have adopted things that were put in place originally in Medicare. We've seen that over the 70s and 80s, 90s, and we're still seeing it today.
We're looking at the accomplishments and challenges facing Medicare and Medicaid, or Medi-Cal, as it's known here in California, on its 50th anniversary. We're joined by Lawrence Baker, professor of health research and policy at Stanford University, Andrew Bynum, professor of medicine, health policy, epidemiology, and biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, and Diane Rowland, executive vice president of the Henry J. Kaiser Foundation. So Medicare, though, is not without its shortcomings. Some of the things that I hear often is that it's still hard for people to pay their premiums.
Medicare faces some serious financial challenges going forward. It's a big program. It's got a lot of people, and those people depend on it for some pretty expensive health care. And so Medicare, looking forward, has to start to think about the ways that it's going to meet the growing number of people coming onto Medicare, the baby boom generations retiring, people are living longer. And the folks on Medicare are demanding and really should properly expect to receive more sophisticated, expensive health care. And so that's going to create some financial challenges. Some of that's coming back onto the folks who are asked to pay premiums for these things for parts of Medicare. And I think one of the big challenges is how we navigate the cost of Medicare and the expectations we place on beneficiaries, because it is a very important program that ensures or provides access to very key services. And it's a big challenge.
Diane Rowland, you've also been looking at the challenges facing Medicare. What do you see as sort of the biggest issues that it's addressing, that it needs to address now?
Well, I think there are really three issues. One that Lawrence has just talked about, the out-of-pocket spending by the beneficiaries on the Medicare program, is quite substantial given that the average income is $23,500 a year. So the Medicare population is basically not a very wealthy population, yet they have among the highest healthcare expenditures in the country. And in those expenditures, Medicare provides some coverage, but it still leaves much to be paid for out of pocket in terms of premiums to supplement the Medicare program, as well as cost sharing for some of the services. So one of the challenges going forward is how to restructure some of the financial obligations for beneficiaries under the Medicare program to perhaps be more even-handed in terms of helping those at the lower end of the income spectrum versus those at the upper end. The second challenge, of course, is that Medicare beneficiaries are adding 10,000 new baby boomers every day. So how do we account for this growing population?
And that's also living longer.
That's going to live longer and will probably therefore incur many more health expenditures in their longer lives. And the third is, of course, that technology is changing dramatically, and there are all kinds of new medical treatments, and especially we're looking now at specialty drugs that may be really driving Medicare expenditures further. So how do we sustain the kind of coverage Medicare has provided, meet the new imperatives of how medical care is being delivered, and be able to keep it solvent and affordable within our federal budget?
Lawrence Baker, you have called the situation of Medicare a perfect storm right now. When Diane Rowland hit upon the number of 10,000 or so baby boomers becoming eligible for the system on a daily basis, can you talk a little bit about the status of where we are as a population and that effect on Medicare?
Oh, that's one of the big questions that we're facing over the next 10 or 20 years. We are adding 10,000 people a day. Other people say, you know, it's a couple million people a year, or it's going to double the size of the Medicare population, at least depending on how you look at the numbers and the time periods you look at. So this is going to cost us a lot of money. We essentially finance the Medicare program by asking people who are working to pay the bills of the people who are retired. And I neglect a few details in saying it, but that's essentially the way the program works. And so that increases the burden that we're putting on workers today, and we're going to have to think about how we deal with that. We have real challenges, I think, in terms of the spending. Now, the good news, and I'll just don't want to go too far without pointing out the good news of the last week or so, is mm-hmm. the trustees report, which has come out and suggested that some of the spending increases that we might have expected 5 or 10 years ago really haven't come to pass, and I think we're still debating exactly why that is, but there are reforms in the Affordable Care Act. There are other things changing in the healthcare system that seem to have slowed, at least for a time, growth in Medicare expenditures, and you know that helps us out a little. So it's gotten us a little more breathing room to start to address some of the real challenges that we're facing. And so I think it's we want to see Medicare get to 100 and have another birthday party for Medicare in a while, and we're going to have to start to think about how we grow it or how we deal with the growing population. But the good news is we've gotten a few more years to think about that because of the changes in spending growth.
Yes, and that's a very important thing to point out. Andrew Wyman, you worked on the Affordable Care Act. Do you think Affordable Care Act policies are responsible in part for the slowdown in cost growth that we're seeing with Medicare?
Well, it's as Lawrence said, it's one of the million-dollar questions right now is trying to figure out what has been the causes for the slowdown we've seen. I think the things that have been helpful in terms of what the Affordable Care Act did was to really open up the opportunity to think about innovation in payment models and to really recognize the importance of how healthcare providers work together and the efficiency that can be gained about certain organizational relationships. Some of your listeners may be aware of terms like accountable care organizations and bundled payment and new ways that we're experimenting with paying for services and how that's changing relationships among providers and thinking about their responsibility to not only provide the highest quality care but also to think about how to manage the resources as efficiently as possible. One of the really big changes in healthcare is moving toward getting providers to come together and take responsibility for a population of patients and to identify who are the sickest among those and what kind of resources do they need and how to efficiently allocate those resources in the best way to keep the whole population as healthy as possible. That also means attention to prevention and primary care and making use of things that can prevent people from getting out on the sickest end of the spectrum, where, of course, it becomes more costly. So I do think the Affordable Care Act is They're studying a lot of demonstrations and experiments of some of these new payment models. I think everyone's hopeful that some of them will really be successful, but of course we need to test that out. But if more than anything, I think it's created an environment in which we've kind of hit the restart button on how we pay for these services and think about the responsibilities of providers, not only for providing the highest quality care, but also how to efficiently use the resources.
Are there any examples of these innovative projects locally that you're keeping an eye on that you think are promising?
Well, here in California, we do have a large number of accountable care organizations, which is when providers, hospitals, and community physicians come together and take responsibility for a defined population of patients and really start to look at how to manage those resources more efficiently for those patients. So California is definitely a part of this wave that's around the country of doing that. Another really important model is one that's known as the a patient-centered medical home, which is also really trying to enhance capacity in primary care practices to make greater use of information technology to help primary care physicians to identify those individuals with chronic care needs within their practices and to assign care managers and other members of the team to take care of those patients in ways that are much more anticipatory and recognizing ahead of time before the patient ends up needing to go to the emergency room or to the hospital how to prevent that kind of activity. So we are seeing a large number of organizations in our state engage in that activity, and they're part of really a nationwide set of demonstrations in this area.
In addition to demonstrations, you also mentioned the payment reforms under Medicare. How are they affecting hospitals and physicians, especially, say, small, you know, or rural hospitals?
Yeah, well, one of the things that is going on that we're seeing in the marketplace is a consolidation of healthcare providers. We are seeing that individual physicians out in practice, the idea of a single physician going out and hanging up their shingle, if you will, to practice is really a very dramatically changed environment today. In fact, I was lecturing with some of the medical students at UCSF, and I said, how many of you ever imagine after graduating you're going to go out and just open up your practice? And not a single hand was raised. And that's a very dramatic shift from, say, 50 years ago when Medicare and Medicaid were born, when it was very common for physicians to graduate, do their residency, and then essentially go out and hang up their shingle and go into practice by themselves. What we're seeing now is much more of a consolidation of providers working in large medical groups. Medical groups are growing rapidly. In some cases, hospitals are buying practices and figuring out how to integrate working together. And so while this is a little bit slower perhaps to be happening in the rural areas than in the city areas, I think it is still a pretty substantial change in our environment where we're seeing this consolidation. And pretty soon in our most of our large metropolitan areas especially, I think you will see a limited number of large medical groups that are competing with one another for patients.
Lawrence Baker is somebody who studies this, the economy of this system. What do you think about that?
I think this is one of the concerns that we're starting to see the effects of in terms of pricing. You know, this is an issue for Medicare to some extent, but it's an issue for the entire healthcare system.
Yes.
And may even be more acute, a more acute problem outside of Medicare. We see these large organizations at one level, hopefully, in the sense that they may be able to improve efficiency, they may be able to improve coordination of care, maybe they can provide a higher quality of service overall than is provided by providers who might be separate. But one of the clear things that's also happening in some markets is pricing power is emerging on the side of these very large organizations. They're getting better, bigger, more sophisticated, and they're understanding better and better every year what to do when they control a market area and they're able to go to insurance companies and demand higher prices. And so it's really a trade-off. Can we get the benefits of these larger organizations? Because I think the evidence is pretty clear that when you get integration and really works well, you can drive higher quality, but it takes getting that right. But at the same time, you're going to create this sort of market power problem, and we're going to have to think about that. I think Medicare is going to be a big player in this. Medicare is trying to encourage the formation of these organizations, and Medicare in its current form may be able to manage some of the pricing effects of that because Medicare has a large administrative apparatus that manages the prices. And it may be that the really important effects of this are felt outside of Medicare, where there's more of a free-flowing bargaining between these very large hospital and physician groups and the private insurers.
Diane Rowland, this is something that you are looking at as well. Do you want to weigh in on this as well?
Well, I think what we're also seeing is a new focus on what part of the healthcare system to look at for cost containment and for care coordination. So on the beneficiary side, we're seeing much more emphasis on managing chronic disease. In the Medicare population alone, half of the population has four or more chronic diseases. And so looking at patient-centered care is, I think, a way not only of managing the costs better, but also of providing better, more integrated quality of care. And we've seen really a shift from the fee-for-service system where people are choosing different providers to a better comprehensive coordinated care model that's true in both Medicare and Medicaid today. So we think the new focus is really on how do we take care of these high-cost patients who make up 10% of the population and over 60% of the cost, and how do we do that better?
And we're talking with Diane Rowland, Executive Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, and Dr. Andrew Beinman, Professor of Medicine, Health Policy, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco. We're also joined by Lawrence Baker. He's Professor of Health Research and Policy at Stanford. On Facebook, Catherine writes, "I'm a Medicare recipient, and I thank God for it. It saved my life. I have MS. My question is, why can't Medicare cover dental care?" And this is something that is asked frequently, and I think some folks who don't have Medicare don't realize, is that dental care is not part of the Medicare package, Diane Rowland.
It's true. Just as drugs were not part of the original package, dental care is not part of the package. And dental care is also an optional benefit and not offered for adults in many Medicaid programs. And as one of my former colleagues likes to say, but the mouth is a part of the body, and taking good care of the mouth helps to further better health of the individual. And yet that it remains one of the gaps in the benefits and is one that obviously is very expensive. And one of the tragedies that we see is when they have clinics for free dental care, thousands and thousands of people end up coming to try and get an option to see a dentist. I think it really remains one of the big gaps in all of our health insurance programs.
Another big gap is the fact that it doesn't cover long-term care, extended stays in nursing homes. Lawrence Baker, I see you shaking your head.
Well, so in much the same way that Diane was just talking about dental care, this is an emerging area. It's actually not even emerging that much anymore. It's been clear for a number of years that we have real challenges in this area. You know, we've seen the Medicare program adopt coverage extensions in kind of a piecemeal fashion over time. It started with a fairly narrow set of things, and you know, slowly it's evolved, and people, different groups got added. We had a prescription drug coverage at one point, and so I think one of the things that's really ripe for discussion is how this country is going to handle the long-term care issues, and Medicare has got to be at the center of that, and it almost you know, feels like the time is coming where we're going to have to start to think about that much more seriously.
A listener writes, as a recipient of Medicaid. Oh, I'm sorry, Diane Rowland, go ahead.
I was going to just say this is an area where Medicaid has really been the true partner of Medicare, helping with first nursing home care, but then now really moving to do much more innovative home and community-based services so that individuals are really getting some experience in how to deliver care at home and keep people at home, especially for the disability community. But Medicaid alone cannot take the full burden of the growing needs for long-term care. And so it's been on the political agenda. We've had commission after commission try and figure out how to do long-term care. The Affordable Care Act had a provision called CLASS that tried to get it through. That's been since repealed. So I think solving our long-term care problem is our biggest financing.
And Diane Rowland, thanks. We will continue our examination of Medicare and Medicaid, or Medi-Cal as it's known here, as we go after the break. But tell us your Medicare or Medi-Cal stories. Give us a call at 866-733-6786 or email us at kqedforum@kqed.org. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at the accomplishments and challenges facing Medicare and Medi-Cal on their 50th anniversary with Diane Rowland, Executive Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, Andrew Beinman, Professor of Medicine, Health Policy, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, and Lawrence Baker, Professor of Health Research and Policy at Stanford University. And Andrew Beinman, we've been talking about Medicaid, or Medi-Cal as it's called here, and it too is having its 50th birthday. It's a program that has gone through extremely significant changes, especially recently because of the Affordable Care Act. Talk a little bit about those changes, if you would, and especially how they've affected California.
Yeah. So Medicaid, or what we call Medi-Cal here in California, is an incredibly important program for helping low-income individuals be able to gain access to care. We have, as you recall, with the Affordable Care Act, the original intention of the Congress was to expand the Medicaid program throughout the country in all states to essentially set an income level of 138% of the federal poverty level to allow every low-income individual to be able to get access to the Medicaid program. Subsequently, the Supreme Court made a decision that this should be an option for states and not a requirement, even though the funding for this expansion was entirely provided by the federal government. California has been a state that has taken up that option, was one of the first states to step up and to do that. And we've seen a tremendous number of our uninsured be able to gain access to coverage under the Medicaid program. More than 2 million new beneficiaries have come into the program.
And there have been about 12 million in total
So? That's right. So about one in three Californians is now covered through the Medicaid program. This program is critical in providing access to care for these individuals. But as your question raises, this is a big wave of new people coming into the program, which of course requires some ability to accommodate new individuals. And as the law is really about providing access to coverage, the next question is, does that coverage provide access to care? Can they get in to see a doctor when they need it and so forth? And I think the Affordable Care Act anticipated this in part. It provided substantial new funding for community clinics, for example, to help them expand their capacity. It did have a limited option to also increase the payment rates to primary care physicians to allow them to take on more patients as this wave of new beneficiaries came in. And we are seeing in different parts of the state, there are different growing pains as people come into the system. But in general, I think people have been generally quite pleased with the ability of Medicaid patients to be able to come in and get services that the state did try to flex to anticipate some of the capacity needs it would have to get people services. But, you know, that's still in some ways being sorted out. And some of the biggest challenges are in parts of our state where there were already shortages of primary care physicians. So, for example, some of the biggest growth in coverage have been in the Central Valley, for example, where there was already a shortage of primary care physicians. And so that creates challenges that the whole system has to deal with in terms of individuals getting covered. But in general, this has been an enormous success in our state to be able to get people coverage. And I think with time, we need to work out the systems to make sure that we can efficiently provide the services so that, as we were discussing earlier, we can make sure that we are both providing great quality services, but also doing it within a budget that makes it reasonable for our state.
Lawrence Baker, physicians who take Medicaid patients or Medi-Cal patients here have raised the issue of reimbursement rates and low reimbursement rates actually driving the shortage of physicians.
Oh, so it's absolutely something that you hear, and it's something that Medicaid in particular as a program, even nationwide, has often struggled with, the lower reimbursement rates for physicians relative certainly to the private sector, but relative to the Medicare program as well. And I think even people sometimes worry about the Medicare reimbursement rates relative to the private sector. You know, this is a hard one for me to think about because a lot of it is, you know, it's based on expectations that people have about what they might earn based on the history. And so some of these things are changing because the budget's a little tighter, the wallet's a little tighter these days. We're trying to think about how we manage healthcare services, and so some payment rates are coming down, and of course that changes people's expectations. But I think it's also certainly possible to look at these these mandated or administered pricing systems and find places where maybe a service is not paid at the rate that it should be in order to make sure that people are really able to provide it in their practices. We find services that are underpaid, and then understandably physicians are worried about providing them. So I think getting payments right, especially in the context of Medicare and Medicaid, has been a real challenge. We're probably I actually infer a lot from the fact that lots of physicians are still very happy taking care of Medicare patients, that while people are always concerned and want to make sure that payment rates keep up, there's still enough money in that system to make it worthwhile for many physicians and groups to be participating in the Medicare program. I think Medicaid's been a little bit more of a challenge, and so I think one of the things that the Affordable Care Act did was try to raise payment rates in the Medicaid program and get that going. That was really helpful. But that also looks like it. Well, it was set to end at a certain point in time, and we're going to have to continue that. So I think there's lots of continuing challenges in making sure the finances work out in Medicaid.
I want to go to our calls. Before I do, I just want to ask the question, Andrew Byman, as someone who's had a lot of experience with a population that uses Medicaid, do you think that low reimbursement rates are having an impact on patient care?
Well, I think
there are real and felt consequences on the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest challenges I face as a primary care physician is when I see patients who have needs where I need to be able to refer them to specialists and so forth. Where you work will have a big impact on your ability to be able to do that. We're very fortunate here in San Francisco that we have a very strong safety net with a terrific set of specialty providers, mainly based at San Francisco General Hospital, that provide opportunities for me to be able to make the kinds of referrals I need to make for my patients. But if you work in different parts of the state, you may face real challenges of being able to get a patient referred to some of the services they may need. And this could also come up in the context of primary care as well, where there can be some real shortages. So I think the payment rates, California has among the very lowest payment rates in its Medicaid program of any state across the country. And I think it is something that we're going to need to look at in our state to be able to try to make sure that we have the capacity to really deliver on the coverage expansion and be able to provide the access to care. And making that investment on the front end primary care will hopefully save us money as well at reducing hospitalizations that are unnecessary and so forth.
And let's go to our listeners. Diane in Georgia. Go ahead, please.
Oh, good morning. I keep hearing you all talk about budgets and stress and trying to make the dollar go further. What I want to know is, with all the buying power that our government, in a sense, has with ACA, Medicaid, Medicare, the states with their individual, why does no one go into negotiating the cost to the American public and the government of drugs? We pay so much more than other countries do.
That's a great question, Diane. Who would like to take that?
Well, I think that you've hit on really one of the big challenges going forward. The cost of drugs, when the Medicare drug benefit was enacted, the government was specifically prohibited from setting prices for drugs and was leaving that to the private plans that would be offering the drug coverage to Medicare beneficiaries. And now many want to reopen that and look at how Medicare can perhaps negotiate some of the kinds of deals for the cost of drugs that the Medicaid program is allowed to have through the drug rebate program that's been in effect for many years. So we're really putting that on the policy agenda as a major issue going forward. But in addition to that, there's so much concern about some of the new specialty drugs that come with huge price tags in the neighborhood of $80,000 or $90,000 per treatment for some of the new hepatitis C drugs. So that looking at how to manage both the cost for the current drugs that we're using, but especially for those that are coming online, is probably one of the most pressing policy issues that we have right now.
Thanks, Diane, for the question. Let's go to Tom in Los Gatos. Hi, Tom.
Hey, good morning, Nina, and the distinguished guests, audience. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm 64 and a half. My wife retired recently. We had the top plan at Kaiser for about 30 years. I was Platinum Plus, and we weren't able to get our life-threatening heart defects, congenital heart defects, repaired, probably because they were, considered pre-existing conditions. And now under the, we have a transitional Affordable Health Care Act until we turn 65, just months away. And still, we haven't been able to get our heart conditions repaired. I haven't even been able to have a colonoscopy or even the prep work. They said my surgeons could give me a heart attack. And so obviously they share the staff of, you know, these various, hospitals, Stanford, the VA and Kaiser and so on. I'm sure the same policy is going to go on in effect when we become seniors. They're going to say, oh, it's a pre-existing condition or, you know, you're too old, so just go home and die. There's obviously, thousands of patients in California who are allowed to die each year because their conditions are considered too expensive to treat, probably nationwide, for something like 400,000 or 500,000 a year, just, you know, told to go home and die because your conditions are too expensive to treat or, you're too old or some other excuse. So also 70% of our doctors have pledged not to even treat, you know, patients with Obamacare. And even my own surgeon in Los Gatos who signed up for the ACA as a good example, you know, to her patients. Now she's been blacklisted. She can't get medical treatment from her physician since she has very serious medical conditions herself. So, we're the only Western country, that doesn't have, single payer, universal health care. Is the problem we patients, we're just too sick, or is the problem is our doctors are too ultra-conservative and greedy?
Go ahead, Lawrence. I see you want to address that.
Oh, I was just going to say this. It's very hard to deal with any individual circumstance, but one of the things that I see in the Medicare program is actually a real success in the opposite direction, and that is it has really been willing to take care of a broad range of patients. It's been very open about the services that it makes available to them. And so while it's very hard to talk to a specific circumstance, and I know that there are individuals who have concerns, I think one of the things that we really see in the Medicare program is an attempt to try to address this problem, and it's been, I think, in many ways successful. So hopefully we can continue to improve it.
Tom, thanks for sharing your story. Let's go to John in Lafayette. Hi, John.
Hi there. I was recently in the hospital in an ICU for a week and then in a regular room for a week. And one of the disconcerting things about the current way health is divvied up is that when I got to the hospital, neither my primary care physician nor my pulmonologist came to see me, and doctors who saw me had no idea of my history, and there seemed to be a real lack of coordination, that if I didn't have strong advocates, you know, when I was pretty much out of it, I don't know what would have happened. And then when I got the bill, the notice for Medicare, as to what they had paid right at $19,000-something for my 2 week stay. So I called the hospital and I said, okay, what did you bill Medicare at, or what was the real bill? And it was $320,000. And ICU room in this particular hospital was $19,000 a day. How does that all play out?
John, thanks for the call. Andrew Byman, I mean, this question about coordination, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I think the caller brings up a really important issue that is really part of the challenge that we have in front of us. You brought up earlier that our population is aging. Well, with that comes more complexity, not just among our elderly, but among the entire population. And more complexity in healthcare means more providers who have to engage in the process. We've also seen a change in how healthcare is delivered, where for efficiency purposes, there has been a movement of keeping the primary care physicians in the office and developing of hospitalists and others who are mainly practicing in the hospital setting. All of this creates communication and coordination challenges. And I think for too long, too much of this, as the caller brings up, has been left with the patient. The patient is an incredibly important part of connecting up, and we want care to be centered on the patient. But we need to take advantage of the new tools that are available through electronic health records and other means to make sure that all of the providers involved in a patient's care are working from the same plan and have the same information. Obviously, they all contribute in some ways to their expertise, but we want that information shared. And one of the real benefits that could come from the integrated care and the consolidation that we talked about earlier of providers is the opportunity to implement in common electronic health records that can share information and so forth. We're not there yet. And there is variability among different systems and different providers about how well that goes on. But this is an absolutely key aspect because it's not only inefficient in terms of the potential for redundant test ordering and so forth, but it's unsafe because there may be things that one provider has implemented to try to help a patient that could have side effects in other aspects of the patient's disease and so forth. So that's a very important set of issues that need to be addressed. And this idea of bringing more of a system that coordinates the care is a critical part of how we need to improve our healthcare system going forward.
A listener writes, isn't it really time to address our out-of-whack medical system? If we switch it to reward preventative care and train our doctors to diagnose without having to perform a lot of unnecessary tests, in addition to training everyone to give patients clear information on their own care, we could save billions. And these are things that actually are being addressed by some of the policy changes currently. Yes, Lawrence Baker.
Absolutely. I think we've had a long history in our country of paying physicians and hospitals in a way that rewards people who do more and more expensive things. And that contributes to the changes in the care for individuals. And it contributes really to the design of the whole healthcare system that then adapts to that structure and builds itself in a way that can deliver more and more of those kinds of services. And so this has been recognized, and there's lots of attention to this discussion of it. And the Affordable Care Act is actually a good example of a program that involves some reforms that are aimed at paying for a bundle of services. So if you come in with a knee problem, instead of paying for each service, we'll pay a specific amount of money. Here's $1,000. Don't quote me on the numbers, but here's some bundle of payment, and the physicians in the hospitals then decide the best course of treatment. And so those would really change the dynamic. And I think there's lots of attention to those in the federal programs, lots of attention to those in the in private programs as well. And we're still figuring out exactly how we do that. It's not always so easy to define those bundles and make the whole system work. But there's a real recognition that we need to change that. And I'm pretty confident that if we did change that, it would change the way that medical care gets delivered. And so it's going to take a little while. But I think we're certainly recognizing and working in that direction.
And we're talking with Lawrence Baker, professor of health research and policy at Stanford. Diane Rowland, Executive Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, and Andrew Beinman, Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
I was just going to raise one sign that's very positive to me about the change that is underway that Lawrence just talked about is the medical community seems to be really getting this and embracing it. One of the signs to me is there's a campaign now across many specialties called Choosing Wisely, in which specialty organizations are stepping up and making it very clear to their members the following kinds of tests or procedures are inappropriate to do in the following circumstance. So if a patient comes in with this complaint, don't do this test. And that's a real change in the kinds of communication among providers to take responsibility to not just always do more. It is about now saying, what are the things we can hold back on doing and would be correct not to be doing? And that's a real sea change, again, of the medical community recognizing that it needs to be doing a better job of managing the resources.
On Facebook, Daisy writes, I am so happy with Medi-Cal. I actually go to the doctor now because I can afford it. It is such a weight off my shoulders. Now, there's another point about saving billions, because previously one of the things that physicians were pointing out was that these patients who weren't seeing doctors for preventative reasons were using the emergency room, which was inherently more expensive. So can I get you on record, Lawrence Baker, as to whether or not you think Medicare and Medicaid are imminently sustainable programs?
Yeah, no, I think I'm optimistic about Medicare. I think
will it be around for me when I reach that point?
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that, there's a lot that's going to come between now and certainly when I retire. And we're going to see more people that are going to live longer, they're going to want more expensive health care. But, when you look at the finances, there are certainly things that we can do within the current structure that would make the program last. There's only a certain subset of things that are possible. You got to raise some additional funds, but the amount of funds we would need for Medicare, they're substantial, but they're probably not out of reach for the country. You got to reduce healthcare spending and manage that money better. And so there are things that we can do there, and we'd have to work hard to do it. But I think we can probably do it. And as I said before, one of the things that's happened in the last few years has given us a little bit longer window to try to do these things. So I'm pretty optimistic. The program is very important. It's clearly something that the country values across across the political spectrum. Lots of people want to see it sustained. And so it's I'm not sure it's going to be a pretty process. It might not be very much fun to watch the politics of how we work all this out. But there are lots of ways to keep the program solvent. So I'm optimistic. You know, something could go wrong, but I kind of think we'll be able to manage it.
And speaking of politics, we are entering an election year, and Medicare does come up as a point of discussion. And we often hear proposals for different payment models, for example. They tend to be quite partisan. But one of the things that comes up frequently, Diane Rowland, is vouchers. And we're already hearing that come up again.
I think these proposals come up and they go through cycles. What I was going to say about the future of Medicare and Medicaid is that their sustainability has been in question for the last 50 years. So this is not a new issue for either of these programs.
Right.
And we've always found a way to fix them. And one of the concerns that gets raised when you put a proposal like vouchers out, which has been there for time, is that it really shifts the cost from the government to the individual. And we already know that there's substantial out-of-pocket burdens in the Medicare program for the Medicare beneficiaries. So I think that these proposals, as Lauren said, will be debated. But the ultimate is going to have to be, how do we keep the American public pleased with the care that they could get through the Medicare and Medicaid programs? And that will be the key in any political debate, so that many of these proposals are going to be offered as ways to reduce costs. But one of the analysis that we have to do is, what's the impact on beneficiaries? And ultimately, they vote. And that's why it's so important, why Medicare has stayed so important. We know that Medicare's constituency is a high voting population.
And I know you mentioned that, yes, the sustainability of the program has been in question for many decades. But I wonder, are we seeing actually a shift for the first time in the conversation, being less about whether it's sustainable and more about, you know, that, yes, we believe it is, so let's do this?
I think that what we've seen is that Medicare and Medicaid, but especially Medicare, has evolved in 50 years. It's changed the way it pays for benefits. It's changed the way it organizes care, and it's changed the financing in many ways to always remain solvent. So I have great faith that we will find a way to keep this program meeting the needs of our disability population and our growing elderly population by changing the delivery system the way Andy and Lawrence have talked about, changing the payment methods, and really making sure that we have good balance in the way these programs operate.
And let's go to more calls. Donald in Berkeley. Hi, Donald.
Hi. So the one caller made the comment about his $300,000 bill, and the one comment I wanted to make is that the hospitals have to maximize their billing because the reimbursement is sometimes so incredibly small. I worked in one place as a physician and got 30% of what I bill, and now the new place that I work at, to do exactly the same thing, I get 70% of what I bill, because our company deals with very specific private insurance.
Donald, I thank you for the call. Lawrence Baker.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to comment on that too. One of the things that we've seen emerge over the last few years in the healthcare system, and Medicare as well as outside, is just kind of crazy billing that goes on. There are all sorts of reasons that drive it, but the numbers that get billed for certain services are often completely almost unrelated to the actual amount that providers expect to get paid. And so oftentimes it works itself out because insurance companies or Medicare adjust those prices to something that's reasonable. The real challenge, though, is that it creates a lot of confusion amongst people when they try to understand healthcare prices. And it also creates real problems once in a while when someone actually gets that bill and has to pay it themselves, or gets one of those very high bills and is expected to try to work it out on their own. And that's a real problem. So I see real challenges with the pricing and a lot of confusion coming from it. That'd be one area that maybe some reforms could look at.
And let's go to Judy in Portola Valley. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I'm wondering if there's any evidence yet that the ACA requirement that there not be readmittances on hospitals with Medicare patients who not be readmitted within 30 days, or there's a penalty?
Yes.
Is there any evidence that hospitals are performing better?
Andrew Beinman?
Yeah, there is actually already some evidence that the readmission rate has started to drop. The new law sets requirements around certain specific conditions, congestive heart failure as an example, and we are seeing nationally that among Medicare beneficiaries that the rates of readmission are dropping. And I'll just tell you that the hospitals where I'm associated with at San Francisco General and at UCSF, there's tremendous attention paid to this issue. And so that it really points out how policy can help to get the attention of providers, that if you align your payment policy, that providers can come together and figure out what are the strategies that we can undertake to reduce a readmission. So we've seen a real improvement in how we get rid of the discharge patients and the kinds of instructions that we give patients about what to anticipate when they go back home, and also putting them in touch with their practices and creating transitions so that if something goes wrong between the time that they leave the hospital and when they're supposed to have their follow-up appointment, that there are ways to address that on a more urgent basis. So the short answer is yes, we are seeing success in that, and those are the kinds of things that we need to continue to work on to make improvements over time in these kinds of issues.
And Peter in San Francisco. Hi, Peter.
Yes, I'd like to know why the Georgia woman who called about the non-negotiation of drugs is allowed to persist. And that question was never answered. We don't know who is responsible. Who is keeping that legislation of change from happening?
Either of you want to take that?
Well, we have a very organized pharmaceutical lobby that I think is the main cause of the stalling of that legislation.
It's really a fundamental question and one of the threats to Medicare costs. And it's an important point to raise. Thank you, Peter. Andrew Beinman, is there anything else you want to say about that?
No, I think Diane, you know, said it correctly. I mean, in working out any of the kinds of changes, you know, our healthcare system is mainly a private system. Obviously, the government plays an important role with these public insurance programs that we're talking about here today. But there are many actors involved in shaping what our healthcare system looks like. And there's no question that the pharmaceutical industry is a very powerful lobby within Washington and has a big impact on some of the policies that are currently in place.
Well, I want to thank Andrew Beinman, Professor of Medicine, Health Policy, Epidemiology, and Biostatistics at the University of California, San Francisco, for joining us. I also want to thank Diane Rowland, Executive Vice President of the Henry J. Kaiser Family Foundation, for joining us as well. Thank you, Diane Rowland.
Thank you for having me.
And I also want to thank Lawrence Baker. He's Professor of Health Research and Policy at Stanford University.
It's been a pleasure.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauberg, and Vinnie Tong. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai and Rebecca Stowe, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much to our listeners for sharing their stories, and thanks so much for listening to this program.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation.